Thank you, Mr. Runyon. Our first question will go to Richard first, and then it'll go to Chris. And Marshall. And that is, what part of your background and experience makes you the most qualified candidate in the race to be a member of the House of Delegates?
I think I touched on it in my opening statement. I think the fact that I've experienced what an overbearing and overzealous government can and will do if given the chance. And we fought back, and we've won. And not only did we fight back, but we fought back against Democrats. And when we're looking at the possible makeup of the General Assembly, it's going to be another close one. And we may even not hold the majority. So we need someone who is not afraid, someone who will stand up and not compromise on any of their principles, on any of the conservative principles that we so hold dear to us, just because leadership may ask us to, just because someone else may ask us to. I'm not beholden to any special donor lists, any boards, anything like that. I'm beholden to the voters. I'm beholden to you guys, because again, I'm one of y'all. I'm not a politician. I think that outsider's approach and the unique experience of having to battle government and reaching out and helping other people who have had similar battles with government, I think that bodes or serves me well.
Thank you. My small business experience for the last 28 years gives me a special feature that needs to be in Richmond. As we see some of the legislation that comes through, you recognize that there's people that have never made a payroll. My wife and I have made $1 million a year worth of payroll for the last 28 years. And I will admit, there were 2 weeks that not everybody got paid. That person that didn't get paid was me, because we paid our employees, and we paid our suppliers, and we took care of our obligations, and whatever was left over wasn't enough for us. But in addition to that, I've been involved in community service my entire life. I've served as Rotary District Governor for Western Virginia and Northeastern Tennessee. You get to see people and experience things in your life when you see what they're able to achieve. Most importantly, from a government point of view, I served on the Rockingham County Planning Commission for 10 years. And it's interesting to see that you deal with regulations on the outside, but when you're involved with them and addressing them on the inside, it makes you understand how much overreach government can have. Thank you.
I think the fight for freedom starts at the local level, and that's what I've been involved in for 8 years now. And you saw Richard had to fight his board, and I've been fighting on the other side, trying to make sure that every ordinance allows people to do what they want with their property as much as possible. I fought to make sure that the rights and rules of the landowner are respected, even if the neighbor does not like what that person's doing. And so that experience, I've seen that. I've seen the tyranny at the local level. We spent 2 hours, for example, talking about how many miniature donkeys equals one donkey to regulate a person that wanted to put donkeys on our property. Ridiculous things like that. Government has no role in doing that, and we should not be doing that. And so I can take that experience to the State House and make sure that the state government does not take away the freedoms of the people.
Awesome. Thank you. Our next question is... We'll go first to Chris, and then same order we've been doing. If you are elected to the House of Delegates, what would be your top legislative priority?
Can you all hear me okay? I can't. Is that everything good? Thank you. So my first legislative priority would be, let me say this. The governor's comments about abortion were despicable and just unimaginable. So my first legislative priority is to continue to support life, and that any legislation that we can bring forward that will support life, conception, life at conception is going to be supported, and any legislation that does not is going to be resisted. So I think that is of utmost interest for me, and I would be very supportive of that initially. My first bill.
Great, thank you. You know, of course I'm going to fight. You've seen me fight against the Board of Supervisors. I fought Republicans. I fought Democrats whenever they moved away from conservative principles. So I'll do that when I get there. But as far as offering legislation, I think the free market works the best. And I think that students and universities don't know how effective their majors are really going to be. And so one of the things that Steve introduced in 2018 was a bill that required all the student success to be put up on website. I would extend that and make sure that all students get a annual letter saying that if you are a fashion merchandise major and you have a 1% chance of getting a job in that area, your average starting salary would be $20,000, and the likelihood of you paying that off in the next 30 years is slim. They will make better decisions when they come to college and follow majors that are important.
One of the first things that I would work on is restoring freedom of choice into so many aspects of state government. And, you know, in doing so, we're looking at freedom of choice in school and healthcare as two primary things, and one of which would be allowing people their own individual freedom, their own individual choice to seek out the health care that they want to seek out. Just because the FDA doesn't agree with it or hasn't done the testing is irrelevant. People have those rights, and we need to respect those rights. When we're looking at education, the money needs to follow the child. We don't need to send it to a voucher program. We don't need to do anything like that. It just needs to follow the student. And you've mentioned it before. We can look at some a la carte options in education. And, you know, to touch on life, you know, I'm the only candidate in this race who has taken a firm stance who would support a pro-life amendment to our Constitution. And that returns that choice back to the people, returns it back to you guys to make that decision, not a board in Richmond or no one else in Richmond.
Thank you. The next question will begin with Marshall. If you were elected to the House of Delegates, what committee would you want to be assigned to most and why?
Well, I think the first committee I'd like to be assigned to would be the House Education Committee. My background in education, I think, is important. I have worked free consulting for local school systems and have realized that SOLs are completely worthless and unpredictable as far as the teacher's performance. And so that's something I definitely want to do. And then Chesapeake Bay House Committee, I think D, is where they work with farmers and water pollution. And that's something in Augusta County I've been working on now for 8 years, trying to push back against the EPA and the DEQ and some of the crazy regulations, and trying to find some common sense solutions to cleaning up the waterways.
I don't think this will be a surprise for anybody. It's going to be ag. That's going to be the committee I want to go on first, subcommittees and the full ag committee. If we're only picking one for the first, that's going to be my number one.
I would wish to serve on the Agriculture Committee. Agriculture in Augusta and Rockingham County places it in those two counties in the top 10 in the United States, I believe. My lifetime of experience as a farmer and working in large agribusiness makes me have a unique perspective on what the challenges that agriculturalists have in the Valley and in Western Albemarle. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Yes, this will start with Richard. You may have touched on this a little bit earlier, so if so, you can kind of summarize it. But what was the worst piece of legislation that you saw the General Assembly attempt to or successfully pass last year? And how would you fight against this if you were elected?
The worst, and we've all touched on it, just because, I mean, how can it not be? It's Kathy Tran's third trimester bill, and followed up by Governor Northam's comments. They were absolutely despicable, and for, you know, I just can't even imagine him ever coming to a point to having to feel like that was necessary to say. I couldn't imagine someone thinking that, and a pediatrician nonetheless. That was pretty disgusting, and, you know, some of the other bills, when you're looking at over 100 gun-grabbing bills, when our Second Amendment rights are under attack in the state of Virginia. And again, I'm the only candidate who stood up here and has been at all the meetings and has said, you know, I will sponsor constitutional carry on day one. Yes, Second Amendment should be the only carry permit we need. However, when the Democrats are coming at us again with over 100 plus gun grabbing bills and red flag laws, and our governor is giddy with excitement, ready to sign those, we have to protect them from the state level.
Kathy Tran's bill and the governor's comments again were despicable, and I think those were the worst. But, you know, there's a large collection of radical leftist bills that came forward, whether they be anti-business, anti-family, anti-community, anti-education. That whole side has just become unhinged with some of the things they propose. There was a bill that would outlaw fossil fuels by the year 2020. Now, if you're that far out of the norm, really should you be in the legislature?
You know, I agree with my colleagues' comments up here, and I think all three of us would fight the extremes. But if you take the package as a whole, everything that the Democrats offered up, all those extreme bills, you kind of saw what's going to happen if we lose the House this year. And it's so important to keep the House because, corn filler cannot be the majority leader over there. And what we need to do is make sure we win and that we get out of the district and start supporting Republicans all the way through. But of course, I'm against the third trimester bill, the $1 billion in new taxes, the 100 gun grabbing bills. I mean, it's just, there are so many things out there that we've never seen in our legislation for the past 100 years. I don't think some of those bills would even been thought of 5 years ago.
So the next question will begin with Chris. As we probably all know, Virginia's political realm has been rocked by scandals in recent months. So as a delegate, how would you work to restore the public's confidence in Richmond?
Well, I think as a delegate, you have to be open and transparent in all you do, and that would offer your personal values back to the constituents. What I would suggest is that we have three of the executive members that really need to address whether they should remain in their service. I think the House and the Senate should come together on a bipartisan investigation of Mr. Fairfax's issues. And then, to be honest with you, I think the lieutenant governor and the governor should have resigned over the issues the blackface issues.
Well, I think it's been an absolute embarrassment. We were on the national news for days and days on that, and the apologies were weak. And so I was, you know, just greatly embarrassed for Virginia. I think when either side makes a mistake like that, we are all punished. And so I think that investigating Mr. Fairfax, I think, is absolutely critical. And then, you know, requesting the other two step down from their roles, I think, is also very important. But I also think we need to lead by example. And so one of the things I've done as a board of supervisor is I've knocked on every one of my doors. It took me 6 months to do. I don't take any salary. I'm the only one in the Valley that does that. So I've walked away from over $80,000 in salary. I do this for free, and I want to continue to serve this way. And I think that just establishes more trust in being out there. Everyone in my district has my cell phone number, my email address, and I continue to work with those people and just make sure that they know I'm around and can help them.
Just like the other two guys, I mean, absolutely. We were embarrassed as a Commonwealth. Every time you turn the news on for 3 weeks, it was either blackface this, sexual allegation this. We were still rebounding from the Kathy Tran and the infanticide comments by our governor. I mean, it was absolutely terrible for the Commonwealth. And, you know, yes, I do agree we should have an investigation into the claims against Justin Fairfax. You know, the other two guys, we can call on their resignations. We can ask them to resign. But again, you're looking at something that happened that's absolutely despicable. But is it an impeachable offense? And I don't see it when I'm looking at the Constitution of Virginia that it is an impeachable offense. So I think we apply the pressure. We point out their double standards. Liberals are famous for having double standards because without them, they wouldn't have any standards at all. So, you know, we need to capitalize on this, guys. I mean, they do it to us all the time. So it's time we fight back, and they gave us a ton of red meat to do that with.
All right. Thank you. So we'll start with Marshall. There's been a lot of debate about how to fund the expansion of I-81, which some of you might have taken in order to get to this debate. And it runs right through the 25th district. What do you think about the governor's recent proposal to fund I-81? And how, in general, do you think that should be funded going forward?
Well, I think many of the Valley delegates voted against this, and I certainly have concerns with how it's funded. There's a bill called Smart Scale, and 6-7 years ago, we passed a tax in Virginia, and it started off at $1.2 billion, and this year it was $800 million. And that difference of $400 million was caused by fuel efficiency gains. And so what we've done is we set up the solution to 81 based on a tax that's going to decrease in value. This is something I even talked to Steve last night about, and he said, well, you know, one of you three has to handle that when I'm out of here, so it's up to you guys. On the other hand, though, there's two other functions of the tax that are on trucks, and so the only way we're going to make up for that gas decline is for trucks to go up. But, you know, we all live on farms, but, you know, every time I fill up my chainsaw, I am paying for 81. Every time I'm filling up my ATV or my skid steer, I'm paying for 81. Even though I'm not using it. And so I think there's going to be some issues down the road that we're going to have to solve.
I'm not sure how familiar you guys are with the governor's plan or the bill that he signed, but effectively it is raising the registration fees on trucks, large trucks. The data shows that the trucks are the ones causing the majority of the problems. It's also implementing a fuel tax along the I-81 corridor. So I do have some worries there that what's going to happen is you're going to start seeing an influx of traffic coming off of 81. driving 3, 4, sometimes 5 miles in, so they can save, you know, 20, 30, 40 cents a gallon. And I think that could cause some potential harm, and I think that was probably an unintended consequence of this. You know, I do worry about some of the higher truck registration. You know, thinking about agriculture, and Mr. Runyon mentioned it, you know, Rockingham and Augusta are top two ag producing or top 10 in the nation. They're the top two in the Commonwealth. So when you look at all the milk that's got to get up and down the road from those dairy farms, you know, the first thing I'm thinking is prices are going up for the consumer. At least there's no tolls, so some of the delays won't happen. But there's still work to be done on 81, and we need to work towards that.
Well, no surprise, our Democratic governor put a large tax increase in. And it's quite unfortunate because it's a regional tax that's really going to impact the Valley's economy, the 81 corridor's economy, and I think unfairly. I am on record against a statewide fuels tax. Motor fuels tax is a tax that's looking backwards, folks. You know, with the advent of electric vehicles, the advent of improved fuel efficiency, it's a declining value tax. And it's an unfair imposition on those folks that don't use the road, that use other places, again, farmer as well. And so I'm paying tax on fuel that'll never get spent on that road. And I think that's unfair. Again, bad for the economy. And it's a short-term solution to a long-term problem. 81, we all agree 81 has problems. And so we need to address it in a more comprehensive and effective manner.
So the next question, we'll start with Richard. As the price of higher education tuition continues to rise for students, Speaker Cox and the General Assembly were able to pass a law incentivizing colleges and universities to roll back some recent tuition increases. What would be your top priorities for higher education policy?
If we're talking about the cost of higher education, then I think that, you know, when you enter into an agreement, essentially that's what you're doing. When you get accepted into college and you choose to come here, you're making a 2 to 4 year commitment. Your price should be locked into that first year's worth of tuition, unless they decide to do a tuition decrease, which never happens. You know, if there are tuition increases and they do feel the need to increase tuition to pay for, you know, the things that the school needs to pay for, then that can happen to the next class, but you're locked into that price. I think that if we start there, it may seem like a small step, but I think that really will go a long way. And, you know, there's some other issues from a federal level, too, that are going on. You know, former Congressman Garrett had the Student Security Act. And, you know, the great thing about that was as a young person, you were able to actually divert some of your Social Security payments into paying off your student loans. So, again, that's from a federal level. That's something we can't really touch. But, you know, if we could lock in the price of education the first year that you agree to attend, then I think that's a great start.
Thank you. Thank you. You know, higher education costs are of significant concern. And what I suggest is we need to hold those that provide that accountable. We need to make sure that transparency occurs and that we need to be able to offer new and innovative ways of delivering the model. It is fascinating to see what the digital world has brought forward to us. And there's technologies that some smart person is going to figure out how to achieve things, but the government's got to stay out of the way. We've got to have flexibility for those people to achieve those things and produce what the new modern economy is going to desire.
So obviously the first bill I offered up about free market practices, I think is one. I am been constantly in supervisor timeout on the Board of Supervisors, and the school board and I have butted heads a number of times, but one of the things I proposed was that we move the governor's school in Augusta County to Blue Ridge Community College. So it costs $10,500 to educate a student in Augusta County. It costs $6,000 to educate a kid full-time at Blue Ridge Community College. So if you just do the math, it makes more sense. If any senior wants to go to community college, that local school system should pay for it through that funding, and they can knock off a year of college. They can knock off a year of career and technical education. They could even graduate with a degree or something that they can go right into and get a job right there. And so I think there's a number of different innovative ways to actually do it the first thing right when we get there.
Thank you. And this next question we'll start with Chris. This is the last pre-prepared question that we have. So if you have any questions, please write them down and pass them to the people we have in the middle. So our last question is, what do you think are the most important challenges facing the 25th district, and how do you propose to address them as a member of the House of Delegates?
I think our most important challenges to our community, our 25th district, is the radical, irrational, democratic agenda, because it does not match our values, it does not match our community, and it really is an aggressive attempt to remake our district, our community, our state in a way that we don't agree with. And so I think you have to look at it comprehensively and address all those issues. And they're pretty straightforward, like Delegate Razul's bill that where you're going to ban fossil fuels. Destroy an economy in 2 years' time? You can't do that. Kathy Tran's bill to allow abortions up to point of birth, and then the governor's comments. So those are just examples of that. The removal, or you know, the challenge to the Second Amendment, the challenge to free speech, all the challenges to our constitutional rights. I think sometimes the other side thinks that our rights really are just privileges that they grant, and that's not true.
Well, I think the key thing here is just protecting liberty. Anytime we need to, I think there's 2,000 bills proposed every year in the General Assembly. Maybe we should propose a few less and leave people alone. And that's what I've tried to do as a Board of Supervisor. But there's real issues that affect people in the 25th that aren't necessarily hot button issues, but are critically important. So one of the things I've been working on in Augusta County is just trying to provide internet to rural Virginia. I'd say half of Rockingham, half of Augusta, are just deficient. You don't even get cell service in large portions of Augusta County. We have a significant drug issue that we need to talk about. If you look at Richmond and you look at some of my people in West Augusta, the populations look very, very similar, right? They're financially strained, there's high drug use, there's violence, and those are things that we need to address. And then infrastructure. I have 45 unpaved roads in my district. I represent a very rural district, and just coming up with common sense solutions to improve infrastructure.
Actual house. So when we're talking about the Second Amendment constitutional carry, we need actual solutions. We need to stop talking in these broad generalizations. We have 3 weeks until this election, guys. It is so important that we are talking about the real issues at hand and what we're going to do about them, not just repeating the same talking points over and over again. When we're looking at very specific things, we're looking at the economy. I see an agrarian economy here, so I see a traditional economy in the 25th district. But we also have some population centers that there's this new share economy. My soon-to-be bride, Alexia, and I, we operate an Airbnb that's in the top 2% worldwide. We understand what it takes to operate in this newer, modernized share economy that's more peer-to-peer, individual to individual, not people relying on large business structures. But yet I also have grown up and have I've been in equipment sales. I've been a farmer my whole life. I understand the traditional forms of the economy that have driven the 25th to be a very successful district. I'm getting the stop, so I'll stop. But.
So this next question will begin with Marshall. Sure. So this is the first of our online questions. Bradley Catcher asks, where is one issue where you think that you could work well with Democrats on?
Well, I think that 93% of bills are passed by both sides, and I think that's something. One thing is internet. I think everyone understands the importance of internet. When I talked to even supervisors in Fairfax County, they were horrified to know that some people were still in dial-up in the country. And so I think that's an easy one that most people agree is important.
I would look at criminal justice reform. I think our president's done a great job. President Trump introduced the First Step Act. That was I said it with Joe the other day, no pun intended, but that was an incredible first step in the right direction. And that's something that we can work with both sides of the aisle on, and something that we can actually get something done and make work. We're not having to compromise on any principles to do that, and it's just common sense.
I think there's a number of areas that we work together in a bipartisan way. Agriculture, again, with the value or the values of agriculture in this district, it just makes sense that we work through those and deal with the issues that are out there on that. Transportation would be another area that needs bipartisan solution, really statewide solutions. as well as economic issues. There's going to be a number of economic issues brought forward as the economy continues to expand under the Trump leadership. There's many opportunities that we need to seize upon and modernize our economy, recognize how the digital age is going to change and create opportunities for us. I'm a conservative Republican because I believe that gives the most opportunities for each of us. Smaller government, less interference, less regulation. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Our next question will go to Richard first. Devin Combs asks, recently Virginia Democrats have rejected the idea of a bipartisan committee to hear the testimony of Vanessa Tyson and Meredith Watson, the two women who have accused Lieutenant Governor Fairfax of sexual assault. What do you think should be done by if Democrats won't allow them to testify, even if Republicans are open to some sort of bipartisan committee?
I think we continue to push for a bipartisan committee. We find a way to bring these women's stories up to the light. I mean, we had to sit through this with Brett Kavanaugh, and we sat through, I mean, at one point it was like 20-some women, and then it went back down to two, and it was all fake. It was all fake news. What we need to do is we need to hear these women's stories, because again, we're seeing it play out. The Democrats do not want a bipartisan committee. Back to their double standards. They can hold us accountable for things that we don't do as Republicans, but yet when they very well may do the same thing as a Democrat, it's okay. That's not right. So we do need to hear those girls' stories. We need to give them every benefit of the doubt. Again, Lieutenant Governor Fairfax is innocent until proven guilty, but we deserve, and the ladies deserve, to have their voices heard.
Do we all answer that same question? Or repeat the question, please?
So the question is, in light of the fact that Virginia Democrats have rejected the idea of a bipartisan committee to hear Ms. Tyson, Ms. Watson's remarks, what do you think should be the next move going forward, considering they won't come to the table?
I think we continue to push for that. There needs to be a resolution, and Mr. Fairfax is due his day in court, and I would encourage the various states where the alleged incidents occur to go ahead and pursue that. That's going to be the resolution. And Mr. Fairfax needs to also look deep within his soul to know what is the truth and then bring forth that.
Well, I think, as Richard said, it's pretty frustrating that they won't do a bipartisan hearing on that. I think it's critically important for fairness that everyone sees that and both sides have questions, just like we've seen Republicans being grilled as well. And so I would continue to push for that. But at a certain point, it needs to happen. And so if they refuse to do that, there's got to be a way that we can process that fairly and make sure that Mr. Fairfax does get his day in court.
Thank you. The next question will begin with Chris. So Christopher Tomlin asks, everyone in a Republican primary claims to be a conservative. What does being conservative mean to you?
Conservative means to me that my values, my belief in life begins at conception, my support of the Second Amendment as an unfettered right, not a privilege, and my support for the Constitution overall. Those are values that I support, and you cannot compromise on those. You never compromise on those. Matters of convenience can become bipartisan. Matters that are not going to attack your values and make you make bad choices, you need to maintain your values every moment. And so that, I don't know how to answer that differently.
As Republicans, we have something great. It's called the Republican Creed. And that makes life a lot easier for us. The Democrats don't have a creed. I've looked it up. I've searched for it. It's whatever is nice at that moment. It keeps shifting. And right now we see in their Congress, it's messing up their publications and their bills and everything they're trying to work on. So the Republican Creed, and obviously following the Constitution. I think that's what it means. But really being conservative, just leaving people alone. Government has a role in this society, but it needs to be small and it needs to be out of people's lives.
I'll say something that, again, might not be the most political thing to say, but I'm not a politician, I'm a farmer. Being conservative doesn't necessarily mean Republican or Democrat. Being conservative means following the principles and the values, like Mr. Runyon was talking about, but it also means following the Constitution. It means that no matter what, at the end of the day, we have this guidebook, right? We have this set of instructions, and no one likes to read instructions when we get something new in the mail and open it up to put it together. But we have a pretty darn good set of instructions on how this thing should work. And we need to live by that. We need to follow that. You know, you're looking at free market principles. You're looking at personal choices, individual freedoms, liberties. That's what's being a conservative. It's not partisan. I mean, it's become partisan. But at the end of the day, being conservative, it's about a set of values, again. And it's not necessarily down a party line.
Thank you. The next one will begin with Marshall. Hunter Brown asks, what is your opinion on the recently passed law raising the age for tobacco usage?
Yes. So I actually talked to someone whose son was fired because he actually sells vaping materials. And so it actually hurts some of the economy and some people. I don't necessarily agree with smoking. It's something that eventually killed my mom. She died from lung cancer. So I've never smoked, and I'm generally against it, but I think people should have the freedom to make their own decisions.
Yeah, it was an attack on our individual liberties by raising that age. I mean, again, by doing something with alcohol, by doing something with tobacco, it's a small step, kind of like the whole thing with the revenue sharing agreement here in Charlottesville, right? If we pull out the revenue sharing agreement, it's going to hurt the education funding for the kids in the city. So we hear education, and all of a sudden, oh, we have to save the children. With tobacco use, that was the same case. At the end of the day, they were taking away a liberty, taking away a right that, 18-year-olds have been granted for years, and all because the big tobacco lobby was pushing it, because one of the biggest tobacco industry leaders just purchased Juul for billions and billions of dollars, so they were trying to protect their own market with some of the national fallout that was happening. So again, it was small, it was subtle, but it was still a dig at our liberties.
18-year-olds can vote. 18-year-olds can go to war. So I'm not sure that an 18-year-old should be prohibited from buying tobacco. So I think that's where we fall out on that.
Thank you. This is the first of our written questions, and we'll start with Richard. Do you intend to pass any legislation concerning free speech on Virginia college campuses?
So, this is actually a personal story for me, because again, Alexia, when she was here at UVA 2 years ago, she was told she could not go to the inauguration of President Donald Trump because her teacher was liberal and her teacher was forcing an agenda down her throat. And Alexia can tell the story better than I can, but Alexia showed up to class that day and it was a silent protest. So there wasn't even a class to be held. And she missed a historic opportunity that, frankly, no matter who was getting sworn in, any teacher, any academic professional should let their students go to something like that. To target students, to force these agendas down students' throats, especially in public institutions, is flat out wrong. So when instances of that are happening, when we see free speech starting to be limited on campuses, we see the president, it's a shame that it took the president having to get involved and that we're at that place now. But the president's gotten involved, and on a state level too, we need to make sure that we cut funding or we heavily reduce funding in the areas where those schools are directly depending on it if they are infringing upon anybody's constitutional rights.
The First Amendment applies to each and every one of us, and we all should exercise that with whatever passion we wish to. Colleges, public colleges and universities should be a bastion of free speech. And even when there's speech that's not popular with the powers that be, they need to allow that to occur, because that's where we're going to learn and that's where we're going to exchange ideas. That's really what we're all based upon. And how someone that is responsible could try and limit that, you really, again, have to question their judgment and their agenda. So whatever legislation could be introduced to encourage, let us say, the university folks to do the right thing, I would be very supportive of.
Well, I bet the college Republicans in here, have you guys ever held back in class and not said what you really believe, right? And so a lot of my students are kind of tiptoeing around that, and they're afraid to say what they really believe. And I think that's a major issue. In education, you need to hear both sides. You need to be able to debate freely. And so I'd absolutely support anything that encourages free speech on campus.
Awesome. Thank you. This next question will begin with Chris. There have been multiple bills proposed in favor of ranked choice voting at both the local and statewide level. In Virginia General Assembly, how would you vote on a ranked choice voting bill? And what are your general thoughts?
Yeah, I would be opposed to that. I think our voting system is fine the way it is. One person, one vote. And don't see why you'd want to change that.
I don't support those changes. I'd be against that as well.
I'll mix it up. I would support ranked choice voting. So.
Okay, this next question begins with Marshall. Are you in support of bringing power back to the states by calling for a convention of states using Article 5?
I do support convention of states. It's in the Constitution for a reason. Our founders have been full in everything they've done, and so I think that'd be a good thing. I would put restrictions on what could be discussed. So if we sent out like a balance amendment, would be great to add to the Constitution of the United States.
Lady actually brought this up to me earlier today. I'll be point blank honest, guys. Convention of States, for me to sit up here and to talk about it, I'm going to have to do a little more research on it. I know that may not, again, be a political answer, but that's the honest answer and that's the truthful answer. What I do know about them and what I do know about it is I am supportive, but I do have some concerns. And if constitutionally and legally you can put amendments in there, you can bind it to where we can't eliminate electoral college or some of these things, exactly like the Second Amendment that again we are protected by our Constitution, then I would be supportive of it, but again we just have to be careful what we ask for at a certain extent.
I'm opposed to it, and I've had discussions with Senator Mark Obenchain, and I'm aware of Senator Black's position on this as well. The concern is, how do you keep from having a runaway convention? And if we recall in 1776, the Articles of Confederation, they met to address those, and they threw them out and came up with a new Constitution. Fortunately, it worked out really well, but does anyone believe that given the political climate in Virginia today, we would elect a conservative, responsible group of people to represent us at a constitutional convention? And so I would be unwilling to take that chance given some of the screwball legislation those folks have proposed in the past.
That's everyone. Okay, thank you. This next one will go to Richard first. So compared with Arizona and some other states, our charter school legislation seems to discourage charter schools. What changes would you propose to encourage the increase of choice?
So when it comes to education, again, these are decisions that need to be made in the home. These are not decisions that are best made in Richmond or in Washington. My mom was a public school teacher, and as much as she was in the public school system, and in Albemarle County, we have some of the best public schools in the whole Commonwealth. We still sought alternate education for me because of how I learned, because of wanting to introduce a faith-based component into my education. And I went to the Covenant School here locally, and that education definitely prepared me extremely well when I went to school and when I've done other things in my life. Again, the money needs to follow the student. We need to stop paying into this massive fund. If we want to use what the government's offering, fine, pay for it. But if we don't, we don't need to be paying for that. We need to be paying for education that's going to directly affect our students and our children.
I'm supportive of charter schools as I'm supportive of private, and I'm supportive of a very robust homeschool market and opportunities. I think that the goal needs to be educate the children in the best way possible so that they can come and be productive members of our community and get to work and earn their living and raise their families. I think funding needs to be addressed and how the restrictions on funding needs to be addressed. I think there needs to be flexibility. We not mentioned in this particular thing, but I would be supportive of the Tebow rule in that I do not understand why, if a public school system has a resource available, that an individual that's not enrolled full-time in there should not participate. Their parents pay the taxes as well. And so it's an issue of fairness, and it's an issue of focusing on what we're trying to achieve, which is educate our children.
Thank you. I represent an incredibly diverse educational population. I have a large Mennonite community in my district, and so many of them educate homeschool, many of them send them to Christian school. We have a number of homeschoolers that just do a great job, and we have some homeschoolers that educate just three or four students and really focus on them. And so I support charter schools. I think there should be diversity in education. I don't think there's one right way to do it. I think kids with certain needs and different personalities and different slants will be, you know, be educated any way possible. So I think that the more options they have and the more options parents have, I think the better off we all are.
So next question will begin with Chris. Can you discuss your stance on occupational licensing reform?
That's an interesting question because I actually have an occupational license. I'm a general contractor, I'm a sign contractor, and we're also electrical contractors, so I've dealt with this. I am not aware of any particular issues that need to be addressed other than the occupational licensing system needs to be modernized. There have been some steps made forward in the components that I'm dealt with. If there are other areas of occupational licensing that need to be addressed, I'd be happy to have that conversation and discussion.
I think to be able to cut hair, you have to pay $15,000 in education, and then you have to get a license to do so, and that has to be renewed annually. If I get a bad haircut, I'm just not going to go back to that person. There is a better way. So we have so many different licenses out there that just aren't needed. And so I would, at any point, try to reduce those, make sure they're common sense, maybe if there's safety involved, if there's something critical, important, but not for haircuts and those type of things.
As far as reform, I would want to eliminate occupational licenses. I just think that they're an unnecessary expense and a burden on starting new businesses, especially with young people as we're trying to start new businesses. A lot of the times we're faced hurdles that we can't even go over. I mean, we have a great idea. We have something that will, you know, serve our community well. We can't afford to get it off the ground, or we're too scared to get it off the ground because, you know, we don't know what's coming down the pipe. I mean, on a local level, not a state level, but in our bed and breakfast, I mean, we have to pay taxes on the sheets and the TVs and the forks and the knives and all this little mundane stuff that everybody else doesn't have to pay taxes on because it's in your home. I mean, this stuff is absolutely ridiculous, and it's gotten out of control, and it's these unnecessary redundant taxes that directly affect small businesses. They directly affect our bottom line, and they directly affect the growth of new businesses.
All right, thank you. This next question will go to Marshall first. Would you support a bill legalizing marijuana for recreational use?
No.
That's quick. So I think when you're looking at the marijuana issue and you're looking at marijuana reform, it is twofold. You know, in Virginia, we are just now getting off the ground with some medicinal options. And, you know, I think one's in Stanton starting up. I think there's five dispensaries that will be opening this summer. I think that, you know, we are behind the eight ball a little bit on the medicinal end. We're looking at something that, again, it's back to someone's individual free choice to seek out a medication that they need, that they want to try, that may benefit them. So I think we can definitely do more from a medicinal end. You know, we fast-tracked a hemp bill this year, which is also part of the marijuana discussion, and that went in conjunction with the farm bill that was federal. When you're looking at legalization, again, we would have to look at, you know, particular tax structures and where some of that money would go to. But again, we're talking about people's individual freedoms and people's individual right to do what they want in their house. If it's not bothering anybody, if it's not infringing on somebody else's right, then those rights are protected under our Constitution.
I support medical marijuana. I think it's a great option to the opioid crisis, which has just devastated rural areas and urban areas of Virginia. I do not support recreational marijuana use. I think that we've got a perfect laboratory to watch it because there are a number of states that are, let's say, on the liberal side of the world that have approved it. And some of them have been very disappointed with some of the outcomes. The revenue streams haven't been in place that they were predicted, and they've not started accounting for the potential social ills. So let's let them see how that works, and then we can study it and analyze it. The other thing that's most concerning to me, I think, is there's lots of studies saying marijuana use in youthful brains is devastating, And I think until we understand that better, there can be no movement forward on that.
Thank you. So the next question will begin with Richard. Where do you stand on LGBT issues?
Mm-hmm. Again, I look at and treat everybody the same. It doesn't matter whether you're black, white, gay, or straight. I'm going to treat you the exact same. I'm going to extend the same. No one deserves special treatment just because of their gender or their sexual orientation or anything like that. We are all created equal under the eyes of God. When you do look at some of the LGBTQ whatever agendas that get pushed, would I support a bathroom bill where third graders can go into a bathroom that they just choose to? Absolutely not. Do I support the transgender readings in the classrooms at age kindergarten? Absolutely not. Again, it's stuff like that that does erode and go against a lot of our moral compass. But, we can't punish these people because of how they are. They have every right to be that way, and they're the same, created equal under the eyes of God as me, as Chris, as Marshall. We can disagree with something that they do. We can recognize as a sin if our faith is telling us that, if we do believe in Christianity. But at the end of the day, no one should be punished just for being a little different. So,
thank you. I believe everyone is created equal in the eyes of God. And because of that, I will countenance no discrimination to anyone. We are all citizens of the United States, and we all are citizens of Virginia, and we're all afforded that equal protection. I do not agree that certain special considerations and carve-outs should be allowed. The bathroom bill is a great example of that. It just seems like there's not been a lot of common sense used in what we're trying to achieve in this world.
As a professor, I absolutely fight for every one of my students, regardless of their political leanings or anything about them. And I write recommendations for all of them if they want it. And I try to support them in every way possible. I don't support the bathroom bill as well, but I think the next realm of this debate will go into religious freedom. And so how much can the state require religious institutions to support or not support these type of policies and procedures? And I think that's sort of the next issue that we're going to have to fight in the General Assembly, and we'll have to discuss and think about very critically.
Thank you. Our next question will go to Chris. It's kind of a brief one. It just says your position on immigration, and it doesn't specify legal or illegal. So I assume just address both aspects of that.
Okay. Couple of things. It's a federal issue, and I support controlled borders at a federal level. Obviously, as a Virginia legislator, I would not get a vote on that. But sanctuary cities is probably more appropriate discussion relating to this question. I do not understand why a civil government would decide which laws to enforce and which ones are not. And I am opposed to the de facto sanctuary city creation that has had, because various police forces or sheriff's departments in various cities throughout the Commonwealth have chosen not to enforce ICE detainers. Seems like to me it's an irrational action. If you don't like the law, there is a process to change the law. You just can't ignore it.
I think Theodore Roosevelt first saw that not enforcing a law creates corruption and creates double standards and allows for civil issues to rise to a higher occasion. And so I think anytime there's a law, we need to enforce it strictly. And if they don't like the law, then it needs to be changed. So I don't support sanctuary cities. I think that we need to support and fund and work with ICE whenever possible. And I think we need to make sure that we're part of the solution here in Virginia. We've seen different counties that have strictly followed these rules improve and decrease in crime as well.
So sanctuary cities, again, immigration as a whole, there does need to be some reform there. When you're looking at it from the agricultural sector, I would absolutely love it if we could go up and down 29 or 81 or 64 in any of these orchards, any of these large farms, if we could have them 100% staffed with American citizens. Trust me, that would make my day. The reality is that's just not the case. It doesn't play out that way. So we do need to streamline and make sure that the people who are coming here and want to come here legally have the most efficient, best way to do that. And we also need to punish those who come here illegally, because that's also messing up those who want to come here legally. We need to not be supportive of sanctuary cities. Now, I'm a constitutional guy. I understand the constitutional argument on both ends, and I think the constitutional argument is much stronger to prevent sanctuary cities than it is in support of them. And, you know, when it comes to on a federal issue, again, we won't vote on that, but we do need to secure our borders through physical barriers and through technological barriers, but we need a physical barrier, plain and simple.
So this next question will begin with Marshall. It's the last question that we'll be doing, and it's another online submission. Hunter asks, do you support work requirements for Medicaid expansion, and if so, in what ways?
Well, I don't support Medicaid expansion, so that's the first problem with that question. And if you look at the work requirements issues, that was an agreement. I don't think they come fully into the fold until, what, next year or the next year after that. And so I suspect that the Democrats put that in there so that they could take it out later before it actually got enrolled out. So if we have to live with Medicaid expansion, I think the worker requirements are a necessity.
I'll ditto on what Marshall had said. You know, I don't support expansion to begin with. Because of Obamacare, we got Medicaid expansion. So we have to remember kind of where this all started from. And, you know, when you're looking at work requirements, it shouldn't just be on this. It should be on entitlements in general. I understand disability is one thing, but any able-bodied person who is on an entitlement needs to be able to work. Again, Social Security is a little bit different, but there is reform that can be done there on a federal level. But again, you need to work. These entitlement programs were not lifelines. They're lifesavers. They're not lifelines. You're not supposed to live on these things forever. You're supposed to help you get through a tough time, and you can personal responsibility, and you can pull your boots up by the straps, and you get back on that horse, and you create and you do better than you did before. And they help you move on, and they help you move forward. But you know, expansion in general, I'm honestly surprised we didn't get more questions about that. I mean, healthcare, we could have addressed that in so many different ways by just restoring choice, by looking at some co-ops. I mean, there's so many options. Again, I'm getting the stop. 60 seconds isn't enough to go into that. But you can check out my website, fox4va.com. We've got some more stuff on healthcare on there. So.
I thought you were not a politician.
Medicaid expansion has been a colossal failure from a cost point of view. The costs are running away, and we did not reform the process. And so many times, those folks on the other side with good intentions in their hearts do not understand what the realities are. And the economic realities are we have to control our costs. We are starving education, transportation, and other necessary services of the government because we have this ever-expanding cost. We need to step back, take care of those people that need to be taken care of, but we also need to manage our costs. You know, one thing a business owner learns is that you don't solve your problems just by throwing money at them. You manage through those problems. 28 years of doing that has made a difference, and I understand that.
All right. Well, time definitely flies when you're having fun, and it has come to the point of this evening for our closing statements. So we're going to kind of break the order we're going in, and Marshall's going to begin by giving the first closing statement.
I went first in the very beginning.
No, that's the order. If you go first opening, you can do first closing.
Okay, just want to make sure.
Yes, you don't get the first and last word.
No, that's good.
We're trying to avoid.
Which is fine. Well, again, thank you for coming out. It's an exciting day to be here at UVA, and you guys all took the time to come out and to watch three politicians discuss a lot of issues here. And so, you know, I'm running on my proven conservative track record, and I want to continue that track record in Richmond. I want to be in Richmond to fight these liberal policies. We've seen some of the worst policies ever introduced in the state of Virginia, and I've shown I can fight Republicans and Democrats alike, and I want that opportunity. So if you give me that opportunity, I'll go down to Richmond, and I'll make sure that I'll keep my word, just like Trump did, and I'll fight for everything that I say I'm going to. Thank you very much for coming out again.
Again, thank you guys. It's so important that as young people we are involved, that we are active, and that you know we know what's going on and we know what we're talking about. And you know, again, probably going to make a political blunder here by talking about by saying something nice about my opponents, but we kept this civil tonight and we talked about the issues, and that's important. Again, I mentioned earlier we have 3 weeks until we have this election. You know, we can all waste time talking about each other, but that doesn't help any of you. You guys need to know where we stand on the issues and what we're going to do if one of three of us is elected to serve y'all in Richmond. You know, again, I will go back to the quote I started off with. You know, eternal vigilance is the price of liberty. You know, it is so important that we have people in Richmond who can hold our elected officials accountable, that we have people who will be held accountable and want to be held accountable. To the people and to our constituents that we represent. And again, that's why I've taken hard stances on issues and haven't talked in broad generalizations. I've said I will be constitutional carry and put forth that that legislation day one. I will promote and sponsor a pro-life amendment. When we're looking at civil asset forfeiture, we're looking at so many of these other, they're not the red meat things, but they're very important things. They're constitutional issues where our state government has grown and has gotten out of control, and we need to get them in check. I mean, we need to hold our other body, our whole elected body accountable. And you know, again, what better way to do that than elect an outsider, a farmer, someone from Albemarle? You know, I think aside from Rob Bell, I think George Allen was probably the last representative from here. So I say let's send someone else from Albemarle back there so we can straighten out the revenue sharing agreement and take care of everything else we need to do in Richmond. Thank you, guys.
Thank you. I really appreciate each of you all coming out tonight. It is such a delight to see you, and I hope to be able to have an opportunity to chat with each of you afterwards. So, you know, I'm blessed every day that I wake up. I get to see my beautiful wife's face, and I get to watch the sunrise come over the Blue Ridge Mountains. And I know that when I see those, God's given me another day of opportunity. And I mentioned earlier, that's why I'm a conservative Republican, because I believe our values that we share are what creates those opportunities. Those values of limited government, reduced regulation, constitutional government. You know, those things are what give us the opportunity to live our lives, raise our families, and worship our God. I'm going to protect those. I'm going to share those values with you. Now, we know there's people out there that don't share those values at all. And we know that they are wanting to change how we live and what we believe. And I'm going to work hard and fight any legislation that weakens those values and promote any legislation that promotes those values. So, again, I thank you all. I would ask each of you for your vote on April 27th. I thank you all. And you've done such a nice job with the timer, so I appreciate that. Thank you all.
Let's please give a round of applause to our candidates. All right, well, thank you to all of our candidates for doing this. No one broke Reagan's 11th commandment, so that's definitely a plus. Please remember to go out and vote if you live in the 25th on April 27th. It's a firehouse primary, so every vote really is going to count. And let's, you know, pick a nominee, and then let's help them get elected in November. I want to thank one more time the Albemarle County GOP for helping us co-sponsor this, all the different college Republican volunteers who made this happen, and all of you for coming out on a Tuesday night to talk about statewide politics. So thank you so much, and thanks for coming.
Thank you, man. Great job. Thank you.
Thanks so much.